the protests have been colossal by Indian standards, which makes them barely imaginable by most anyone else's. For the last 6 months, Indian farmers have been demonstrating against agricultural reforms, reforms India's government says will liberalise and encourage Indian farming, but which Indian farmers fear will destroy their way of life. The protests have ebbed and flowed, but at their peaks, the numbers occupying the streets of New Delhi have been estimated in the hundreds of thousands. Right now, they look less like marches and more like settlements. The camps have shops, libraries, gyms, and kitchens, and many of their occupants have pledged themselves to the long haul. The Indian government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi has responded to this dissent with its customary intolerance, this week arresting environmental activist Disha Ravi over an online instruction manual for protests. Has Narendra Modi finally picked a fight he can't win? How does this fit into the pattern of Modi's government by confrontation? And what happens if the farmers won't go home? This is the Foreign Desk.
I certainly don't think the government ever expected farmers to arrive in numbers like this in Delhi. They didn't expect them to stay. They didn't expect them to be able to generate this kind of support for their cause internationally. And the government really doesn't have an answer for it. They don't have a strategy for how to get out of it.
It's the fact that he has never really faced opposition. He genuinely believes that he can get away with it. His entire history tells him that he's been rewarded for every strongman act he's ever performed. There is certainly a pattern, and that is what he's doing here.
This is beginning to damage Modi's Teflon image that he has cultivated sedulously for 8-10 years. And it's beginning to question his ability to bring different sectors of India society into the fold. And he's looking embattled for the first time.
Hello and welcome to the Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. Joining us today from New Delhi are Dr. Shruti Kapila and Joanna Slater. Shruti Kapila is lecturer in Indian history and politics at Cambridge University, and Joanna Slater is the India bureau chief of The Washington Post. Shruti, I'll start with you and the protests and the reason for them. What is the simplest way to explain what it is that this many Indian farmers are this upset about?
So for long, it has been acknowledged by certainly economic reformers that the Indian agricultural sector needs a kind of liberalization, a kind of reform for it. To give a very quick historical background, Indian colonialism or the experience of the empire was most sharply felt by the agrarian community in terms of famines and high taxation. And as a result, post-independence India, particularly under Nehru, never taxed it and protected it against market forces. Now, it's 70, 80 years down the road and India has become a market economy. And the reforms are threefold. One, that they take away the protection against the off-market pricing of essential commodities. So one has to do with pricing of commodities. Second, it has to do with the regulation of the market itself, which is to say that the small farmer under these new rules can directly sell to, say, a big corporate house or the like. And finally, there will be, as it were, a new kind of corporate market force in the Indian agrarian sector. So it's about pricing, because the pricing is controlled and regulated by the state. Secondly, it's about markets and access and who gets to sell and buy. And the third element of it is the nature of the relationship between the farmer and the likelihood of big corporate interests entering the agrarian sector.
So, Shruti, just to follow that up quickly, if I was to ask one of the protesting farmers what it is about these reforms that worries them, what would they be likely to reply?
I mean, the rhetoric around it is along the lines that there's going to be a big corporate takeover. This might be a corporate takeover of big Indian industry, might not be foreign capital. It's probably Indian and indigenous capitalists corporate farmers. So the business houses of Ambani and Adani have become shorthands for, as it were, the negative side of these reforms. So they will say probably that that is what is their key concern, that their land, their holdings, their production, all of this will become subservient to the needs of a big abstract corporate interest.
Joanna, let's talk about the protests themselves. Now, obviously, whenever you discuss the scale of anything in India, you have to adjust it for the scale of India. Lots of things that happen in India are by definition vast when compared to almost anywhere else on earth. But how big are they? In New Delhi in particular, how much of a presence have the protests managed to be?
Well, they're very large. They've blocked three main entryways into the city. And it's hard to say exactly how many people are there, but I would say that tens of thousands is probably the most accurate estimate. It kind of fluctuates a bit because you have people coming and going. But certainly at the main protest site, which is at a place called Singu, there have been tens of thousands of people.
And what are those sites like? Because we should emphasize that this isn't just people marching up and down, waving flags and barking slogans through megaphones. This is in some senses an occupation. There are people talking about staying there for the long haul.
100%. I would liken it less to a protest than to a sort of mini city. You have farmers who have arrived on their tractors with trailers behind them, and now they're living in them. And you have groups that have set up kind of outdoor field kitchens, and they're feeding thousands of people. You have outdoor laundries in some cases. At one point, there was an exercise room. So they've really hunkered down there for the long haul.
And just again, Joanna, what have the responses so far of security forces, police, local authorities been to this? Because this is obviously colossally disruptive to India's capital.
It's pretty disruptive. To be fair, it's not like it's cut off the capital or blocked access to the capital, but certainly it's disruptive for people trying to get into the city from certain directions, and certainly disruptive for the people who live in those areas. The government initially tried to stop the farmers with things like water cannons and tear gas, but when that failed, they took a hands-off approach at first. That changed last month. On January 26th, which is India's Republic Day, a national holiday that celebrates the birth of the Constitution. And that's when there were clashes that broke out between farmers and police. There were dozens of arrests. The government has put up barbed wire at the protest sites to make sure no one can enter the city. Barbed wire, stakes in the ground, huge kind of barricades. And as I say, they've taken a much sharper approach to protesters, to journalists they believe are misreporting the facts. They've shut off the internet. They've told Twitter to take down accounts. And most recently, and perhaps most disturbingly, last weekend, they arrested a 22-year-old climate change activist for sharing a document that had lists of ways to participate in the protests. They're alleging she was part of a conspiracy to set off these clashes on January 26th without citing any evidence.
Shruti, among the farmers, to the extent that it's possible to generalize, how much of their objection is to these particular reforms and how much of their objection is to any reforms? Do they completely reject the idea that the agricultural sector needs to be reformed at all, or are they just not happy about this way of going about it?
I think it's a bit of both. I think there's been a lack of any kind of consensus building by the government, even towards its reform lobby, quite apart from speaking to farmers. What is interesting about the farmers' protest is that if you pedal back every winter for the last 2 to 3 years, there's been a massive protest in the city of Delhi. A year ago, prior to the pandemic, it was against the Citizenship Act. Now, this time around, I think the Modi government feels a bit unnerved. Even though it might want to localize and regionalize the farming issue to, say, Sikh farmers or North Indian farmers, traditionally relatively well-off farmers, it has understood, certainly the government feels unnerved in the way in which it has captured a wider sentiment against the government, but also against the manner in which it pushes legislation. This has now become symbolic of something much larger about how the government operates. How does it want to actually take in people? It's a bit like you started in your introduction with Modi's demonetization in the first term in 2016, which was also just announced overnight. And this too, this is a very, very major issue, has been done overnight as a series of non-deliberative ordinances and bills in parliament. So I think it's fair to say that this no longer is about the farming issue. It's much more about what in totality the Modi government represents for India and its future.
Joanna, is that your sense of it as well, that this is one of those things that started as a protest about one thing in particular and has become a protest about everything in general?
I'm not sure I would say that. I think it really is still focused on the farmers and their grievances. What I do think has spun out of control, at least from the government's perspective, is the international response. I certainly don't think the government ever expected farmers to arrive in numbers like this in Delhi. They didn't expect them to stay. They didn't expect them to be able to generate this kind of support for their cause internationally. And the government really doesn't have an answer for it. They don't have a strategy for how to get out of it. The government just keeps repeating that these reforms will be good for farmers in the long run. But if they haven't managed to convince the farmers of that, then this impasse is not going away.
Just a final thought on that, Shruti, for this part of the program. Whenever the media's eye is drawn to a large protest, then by definition, the story that doesn't get reported is the people who aren't protesting. Is there any cohort of India's agricultural sector which would actually welcome these reforms, that would agree that liberalisation would promote investment, better technology, and would also agree that the guaranteed prices discourage innovation and discourage competition?
Possibly, but the point is that they have not been taken into confidence in the sense that they too could have, as it were, become votaries of these bills. So there's been a very kind of unidirectional communication or lack of it from the government. I just wanted to return to the international aspect that was raised earlier. I think it's fair to say that the question of Citizenship Amendment Act a winter ago, which had the question of the religious discrimination of citizenship at its heart, did draw international flak. And it'll be interesting because Kamala Harris, the new vice president, was part of that pushback. The farmers' protest is a bit of a mixed bag in the sense that, yes, the climate activists internationally have come behind it, as well as various other progressive forces have come behind it. But there's a fairly big lobby in Indian governmental and policy sector which wants this reform. So in some ways, they think of this as Margaret Thatcher's mining moment. Is Modi going to hold his nerve and push it through? It's very much that. But I think, bizarrely, this issue is going to rally international and a much more cross-sectoral support for the farmers than perhaps, ironically, the Citizenship Amendment Act last year.
Shruti Kapila and Joanna Slater, thank you both very much for the moment. We will have more from you both later in the show. Narendra Modi's standoff with India's farmers is scarcely the first impetuous confrontation of his premiership. Previous disruptive interventions have included a reckless currency reform, a crackdown on Kashmir, and a citizenship law read by many as a dangerous nationalist stunt. Are these agricultural reforms part of a pattern of government by showdown? This is Kapil Komareddy, author of Malevolent Republic, A Short History of the New India.
He has been doing this for 20 years. One of the reasons he became prime minister is because people perceived him to be the man who can get things done. In Gujarat, when he was the chief minister, if you were an industrialist and you needed clearance to start a factory, to set up something, he would get you a permit within a few days. And people saw him as the antidote to the bureaucratic nature of India that held India back. When he came to power in 2014, he pushed through a series of significant measures, landmark measures, devastating, cataclysmic measures such as the demonetization, the stripping away of Kashmir's autonomy, and the enactment of the Citizenship Amendment Act. All of these were done without consultation. Some of them were done by lying to people, the stripping away of Kashmir's autonomy. And at each stage, he's been rewarded. He's been, in spite of the protests, people have seen him as the strong man he is. And they've appreciated that because people's experience of legislative reform in India has been a slow, lumbering process. And he promised to get things done. And in doing so, he's eroding the parliamentary structure of India. On 8th of November 2016, with 4 hours' notice at 8 p.m., the Prime Minister appeared on television and he announced that all high denomination currency notes in India were going to be abolished.
To break the grip of corruption and black money, we have decided that the 500 rupee and 1,000 rupee currency notes presently in use will no longer be legal tender from midnight to night.
That was a phenomenally deranged decision. And this is a country in which 90% of all transactions take place with hard cash. And the abolition of those notes meant that there was a wave of suffering that washed through India. People killed themselves, people's businesses were shut, the economy went into contraction, the prospects of a generation were wiped out by that decision. And in spite of the accumulating distress, the Prime Minister refused to revoke that action. And in fact, he blamed nefarious forces that were plotting against him. He cast himself as the real victim of that decision. And the result of that, the upshot of that, is in front of us. So many people in India have struggled to actually, you know, a generation of Indians whom Modi said he was going to give them an income, dignity, prospects in life, they have none of those things. And you can trace that devastation back to that decision. But what is striking in a democratic setup is the refusal of the Prime Minister to walk back his decision in spite of mounting evidence, in spite of incontrovertible evidence of the failure of that decision. That is extraordinary. And that is typically Modi. Kashmir was, Jammu and Kashmir was India's only Muslim majority state. Its constitutional autonomy was stripped away on a de facto basis by successive governments that came before Modi, but Modi formally revoked its statehood, demoted it to the status of a union territory, which means it's run by Delhi. And he did that by lying. He said that there was an imminent terror attack and he asked all Indian tourists in Kashmir to come back. Then he imprisoned the politicians in Kashmir. These are pro-India politicians. He detained them. Then he announced that he was stripping away the autonomy, abolishing the state itself, breaking it up into two pieces. And he did that because the autonomy of Kashmir was always an affront to Hindu nationalists. And it was a long-standing ambition of the Hindu nationalists to tame what was India's only Muslim majority state. And it was simultaneously an accomplishment of that ambition, but also a message to the rest of India that he could do this to them. And a lot of people will tell you in India now that, what has happened to Kashmir is happening to us. Internet bans, arbitrary detention. All of those things are happening all over India now. So Kashmir really was a laboratory for the experiment.
Parliament has passed a remarkable Citizenship Amendment Act. This bill is passed for your future. Legislative institutions have helped to pass this bill. Please stand up and respect Parliament.
The Citizenship Amendment Act in itself is a very noble endeavor. If you're a member of a religious minority in India's neighboring states and you flee to India, then India will fast track your citizenship. India will grant you citizenship. But what it does is it excludes Muslims from that category. So by doing that, it introduces a religious test of citizenship by stealth. And that subverts the constitutional guarantees of equality. And that decision bespeaks the Prime Minister's Hindu nationalism. He explicitly excluded Muslims from that law because of an aversion to Muslims. These agricultural reforms, the manner in which they were promulgated, the manner in which they were pushed through Parliament, that is typical Modi. First, they were introduced as an ordinance. That means they were law without actually going through Parliament. For a bill to become law, it has to go through multiple stages. There were no consultations with the stakeholders. He's held talks with the farmers, but they haven't gone anywhere. And he has refused to walk them back. He said in Parliament not so long ago that these laws would stay. That is Modi for you. He's willing to take a bet. And there are six elections coming up. If he wins those, he will portray those as a referendum on these laws. This is, I think, it's hubris. It's the fact that he has never really faced opposition. The first time he actually faced nationwide opposition was during the Citizenship Amendment Act. But that was opposition from Muslims and secularists. He could ignore them. And he could portray them as terrorists. The second wave of opposition he's facing is from primarily Sikh minorities, because they are the majority in Punjab, and farmers from across the country. He genuinely believes that he can get away with it. His entire history tells him that he's been rewarded for every strongman act he's ever performed. There is certainly a pattern, and that is what he's doing here.
That was Kapil Komareddy. Welcome back to the Foreign Desk. Still with me are Joanna Slater and Shruti Kapila in New Delhi. Joanna, at the end of part one there, Shruti was comparing Modi taking on the farmers to Margaret Thatcher taking on the miners in the UK back in the 1980s. Is there a chance that he has picked this fight quite deliberately, that he knows exactly what he's doing, that he's rammed these laws through Parliament under cover of a pandemic in order to cause a confrontation?
I do not think that they picked this issue to cause a confrontation. I think every government hopes that its reforms will sail through as smoothly as possible. However, I do believe that they did this during the pandemic for a reason. In fact, the government has been quite open about that, that it sees this moment in time as an opportunity to make some fundamental economic reforms that it has been interested in for a while. So they think this is the right time for what they would call bold moves, and what, you know, their critics would say are hasty and rammed through fundamental reforms.
Shruti, so far at least, does Narendra Modi and the wider Indian government seem at all interested in reaching an accommodation with the farmers? That would obviously be a deviation from the Thatcherite narrative.
To be fair, and for what it's worth, there have been a series of rounds of negotiations and discussions with farmers' unions and leaders over the last 2 months, but they've come to nothing. So it will be interesting to see, because the farmers have, as it were, shown a great deal of fortitude and resolution in staying in these protest sites. In fact, in one sense, you can say that the Modi government has already pedaled back, because it has said that there's going to be no reform for 18 months. And in 18 months' time, the whole election cycle for his re-election is going to start. So in one sense, we know that these laws are not going to be implemented. But it is a difficult one for Modi, because he needs to show a big ticket reform, which is not simply cultural, but actually about economy. Because in 2014, when he became prime minister, his main point was that he was going to reform the economy. He was going to be a person who was going to bring India into a new era of growth. Now, up until now, most of the major economic reforms were made, and the architects was the previous government. This is actually something that belongs to the Modi era. And I don't think it's going to come through. In the meanwhile, it's going to damage the government for the first time. This is beginning to damage Modi's Teflon image that he has cultivated sedulously for 8-10 years. And it is ironic, because in some ways you could say that the farmers' protest is important, but is not as fundamental as arguably discrimination at the level of citizenship. But it's beginning to question his ability to bring different sectors of India society into the fold. And he's looking embattled for the first time.
Joanna, is any amount of that being reflected in the coverage of these protests in Indian media? You mentioned earlier in the show that it has not been easy for journalists to report on these protests. It certainly hasn't been made easy for journalists to report on them. Indeed, some have actually been charged with sedition for attempting to do so. But are Indian newspapers, Indian broadcast media, taking a skeptical tone to Modi at the moment or not?
It's obviously hard to generalize with a media that is as, you know, large and varied as the Indian media, but I would say that the mainstream media outlets here, which have been in the past quite friendly to the government, remain so, both in their portrayal of the agricultural laws and the farmer protests. I think the relatively smaller slice of the media that takes a somewhat more independent approach to these issues has definitely reported on these protests with a lot of vigor and a lot of diligence. You've also seen, of course, some regional variations. Many of these farmers are from the states of Punjab and Haryana, so Punjabi papers cover this quite differently from papers in other places. They've been quite supportive of the protesters.
Shruti, the protests themselves have been it's the very definition of the country coming to the big city and bringing its grievances with it. Do you get the sense that there is much sympathy for the farmers among the urban middle classes of India's big cities, especially in New Delhi?
Yes and no. This is a highly partisan society. Urban middle class India, the well-off India, has by and large been very supportive of Modi. And this is where I think his reputation has taken a beating, not because the urban middle classes care for the farmers or it's out of the goodness of their hearts for the farmers that they say so, but I think they are a bit taken aback by the manner in which this reform has been pushed and so soon after several other such controversial bills. So I would think that in general, Modi's reputation has taken a beating. There is not widespread support for the farmers, but these two things are not mutually exclusive.
Joanna, how do you see this playing out from now? As Shruti was saying earlier, the implementation of these laws has been suspended for 18 months, which might, I guess, let some of the heat out of the argument. But assuming the farmers in sufficient numbers are serious about staying where they are for as long as it takes, and assuming Modi doesn't show an inclination to compromise, is there a way this gets resolved, or does New Delhi just have to learn to live with a suddenly arrived new population of itinerant farmers blocking several major roads?
Well, I'm not sure we know the answer to that right now. The implementation of the laws have been suspended at the moment by the Supreme Court, but it's actually not clear for how long. The government has made an offer to the farmers that it would withdraw the law effectively for 18 months, and the farmers have rejected that. So we are back at a kind of standoff. The farmers' demand is quite clear. They want these laws repealed. They've said they will settle for nothing less. And the government, for its part, says that it is doing the right thing for the future of Indian agriculture and for Indian farmers. They say they are a democratically elected government with a majority in the legislature. And while they may have passed these laws quickly and perhaps without due deliberation, they are certainly legitimately passed laws and they are not in any mood to back down. So I don't really know what the way out of it is. So I think we certainly are going to have these protests around for a while longer. I know that, you know, I first went to the protest sites back in December, and even then they were saying they were ready to stay 3 months, 6 months, a year, whatever it took. And I'm not sure I really believed it then, but I do now.
Shruti Kapila and Joanna Slater, thank you both very much for joining us. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Yolene Goffin and Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.